Yeah, have you been around and heard Andrew before? Andrew Sats-McLeod from Finance Feeds?
I've not. You talk about him all day long, though.
Well, he's a good guy. He's the CEO of Finance Feeds, but he's also the journalist that does a lot of very well-respected journalists in the space. And so he really has his finger on the pulse as to what is going on and what's going to affect retail traders going forward. So I asked him to come on the show basically to give us a roundup of the year and what to look forward to going forward. The main things are like new FCA regulations and MiFID regulations coming in to try and protect traders that I think it's actually going to properly affect our trading going forward. So I think it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, definitely.
Andrew, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure and loads of cool things to cover in this episode. But first, I'd like to introduce you to the new bloke, Brandon.
Hi, Andrew. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thanks. Nice to meet you, Brandon. And welcome to the world of multimedia broadcasting to the FX industry.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's good to be here. But today's not about me. It's about you and trying to understand and learn some really cool things that are going to affect the retail traders this year.
Yes.
In the upcoming year, actually.
Well, there are some. And actually, only recently has it dawned on a lot of entities, not just brokerages, but actually service providers and vendors, mainly various components of the industry that make up the whole topography of the electronic brokerage system, that actually the new regulatory structures in Europe are going to affect really not just brokerages, but traders and their relationships with the companies, because European regulatory body, which is the European Securities and Markets Association, is making a new rule called MiFID II, which a lot of brokerages are now concerned with actually getting themselves ready for. And it's going to make a change to the entire structure of how a brokerage is built, in all of its technology, the way the trading platform connects to liquidity, the way that trades are reported, and if a trading platform doesn't connect to liquidity, how those internalized trades are reported and how a brokerage arrives at a certain price. That's just a small synopsis of it. I mean, there's much more to it than that, even.
That sounds extremely intense.
Really is.
My mind is blown already.
It really is. It is very much so. And to make it worse, no regulatory organization across the entire European continent has actually come and stipulated exactly what needs doing and how to adhere to it and how to actually ensure that the companies are compliant and how the clients can be assured that their service will continue without much interruption post implementation.
Excellent.
I thought this, the MiFID II, was like an FCA thing, so like a kind of a UK regulatory body thing, but it sounds like it's not. It's European wide.
And
so I just assumed if you were FCA regulated, therefore that's your kind of regulation that you operate underneath. But there's other regulations that all brokerages have to abide by if they're in the European Union.
That's
as
correct.
Well.
And it's actually the other way around, in that Britain is about to exit from the European Union. However, as far as regulatory continuity is concerned, it will fall under European rules in this particular circumstance. MiFID stands for Markets in Financial Infrastructure Directive. And the first one is 10 years old. So this is the second round of infrastructural rules. But this time they include having to report trades, having to even publish, retail brokerages actually having to publish their entire client base, which is their intellectual property, to
Yikes.
The authorities. So if you think about it, if a brokerage doesn't get this right, then their entire, and they are, let's say they're just like a small white label partnership brokerage based in Cyprus, for example, then their intellectual property is their client base, because they don't have their own technology, they don't have any execution tool. It's purely a client onboarding exercise. And if they are going to take that and put their client details to public information, it means that they're susceptible to having their entire database taken by somebody else without them having to even steal it. They can just look it up. So
these
are some of the pitfalls that brokerages find themselves in.
So just to go back to the one little point there, you mentioned a white label. Just for some of the listeners that don't know what a white label is, could you describe that a bit?
Yes, absolutely. There are two types of retail brokerage in the Western market, and that includes Australia, North America, Europe, certain parts of mainland Europe, and of course Cyprus, which is a hub for retail brokerages. Those are well-established companies that have their own trading platform, companies like CMC Markets, IG Group, FXCM, and so forth.
It's the big dogs.
The big companies, Invast, some of the large companies that have their own platform that they develop themselves, and they've been around for two or three decades and have institutional divisions and so forth. So they are offering an entire solution to traders and to brokers and have their own trading infrastructure. So there's that. Then about 11, 12 years ago, the MetaTrader 4 platform was introduced, and that is a third-party platform developed purely as an outside by an outside software developer. So that gave rise to a very, very low cost of entry for small brokerages to enter the retail Forex market. So what you have is a company called MetaQuotes that makes the MetaTrader platform based in Cyprus. And you can, if let's say you want to start a brokerage, you can just have three or four people, not really much capital, and it'll cost you $5,000 to buy a, what they call a white label license, which means that you don't own the server. They host the server for you, or another brokerage hosts the server, and you just put your logo on the platform. And then you can basically just commit yourself to onboarding customers and sales, and the trades are executed elsewhere, either on the dealing desk of the brokerage that you are taking the white label partnership from, or MetaQuotes will give you the white label part, and they will find a server which will suit your needs and effectively internalize the trades. So let's say you're a company that does that. It's been very cheap to enter the market and then get regulation, but in terms of actually complying to the MiFID rules, it will be very hard for companies like that to actually be compliant, because they don't have control of their own order execution. They are sending it to another broker who's then internalizing it. And some of those brokers are not actually in the European jurisdiction. So if you're a retail trader, this is really important. If you're a retail trader and you're trading with a company that has a MiFID regulated, you know, SISEC regulated platform, which is under MiFID, you might feel very secure. But actually the problem, there are two problems with this. First of all, if that SISEC regulated brokerage has its operations in Cyprus overseen by the Cypriot Regulatory Authority, which is SISEC, they will only oversee the sales procedure and whether the compliance officer is checking documents. Because then if execution is happening abroad, somewhere outside the regulatory jurisdiction, which the regulator wouldn't know because they're not that sophisticated, then it is going to be non-compliant under the European ruling. And the European Securities and Markets Association will check this, because they will see the published, you need to make trade reports and publish all the trades. If something doesn't
right,
apply,
that's
investigate it.
That's really interesting, because it sounds like what you're saying, these rules of MiFID II, it's basically going to kick out the small guys that are undercapitalized, the little bucket shops,
that's
and give more power and authority to the big guys.
That's right, which is good in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So for people who have a brokerage account at a smaller one, they may not even know that they're trading through someone who's just a white label CMC Markets
they
or
wouldn't.
Someone else.
Well, if they're a white label of CMC Markets, then they're lucky, because it's being dealt with properly. But usually they are a white label of somewhere in the Marshall Islands or something, where the owners are from from Vietnam, and then the clients are being onboarded offshore and being given all sorts of different leverage, being also, you know, non-compliant trading terms. And then the offices under the MiFID with the SISEC ruling is just onboarding two or three clients to actually say, okay, we are compliant, have a look at our books. But actually the whole execution and client onboarding is being done somewhere completely non-compliant. And that is a very serious problem. And that's one of the things that MiFID II looks to actually to address. And it's good. This is a good thing for retail traders, in my opinion.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen to a retail trader who has who's trading on a company that they may not know is a white label out of, you know, St. Vincent and the Grenadines or something like that?
Well, what
do you think is going to happen to them?
They still might not get to find that out, but because the regulator will deal with the broker, they won't go to the customer and actually say, look, this is what you're dealing with. They'll go to the broker and say, you're not compliant. You're not making the prices that are being reported and the leverage that's being reported and how these trades are being executed doesn't make sense. So they'll let them go and investigate them. And if their brokerage infrastructure is not compliant, and that means giving best execution, doing it either as an what they call a systematic internalizer, which is a B-book broker that doesn't send its trades to the liquidity provider, but is doing it according to a price feed and onboarding their clients in the right jurisdiction. That is compliant. And then the rest of them will have to be done on what they call a regulated marketplace, which is an exchange. And then an OTF, which is a trading facility, which is like a venue, basically, or a multilateral trading facility, which is very rare among Forex participants and really pretty much doesn't exist. So you're talking about really most of the smaller brokerages coming under the systematic internalizing, you know, B-book category. But that's okay, because that will all be published. And then the MiFID, the regulators under ESMA, will be able to see where the prices came from and whether the customer was given the best execution possible, including how quickly, no slippage, whether it was where the price came from, where the brokerage got the price from. So that's one thing. If they find that there's excessive leverage, which there is in some cases, and doesn't make sense, then it's obvious that these clients are being onboarded somewhere else, and the shop in Cyprus is basically just a front to make it look like a regulated organization. So I think there'll be a massive clear out of things like that. And of course, I was in Cyprus about 2 months ago at a MiFID II regulatory symposium that was attended by compliance officers of brokerages.
Sounds like fun.
Why I went there was because I knew that the chairman of CISEC was going to be speaking there. And I thought, I thought she would just say, she would be someone who would be there just to try and be on the invites to make people turn up, effectively. And that she would say, hi, I'm chairman of CISEC, now over to you. And that would be that. But actually, she spoke for half an hour, and she spoke incoherently and didn't really know the regulations properly. And it just didn't
shock
confidence whatsoever. So I don't think they've got any, most of these smaller companies have got no chance of being compliant on January the 3rd when they have to be.
So we've covered what the companies have to do and how the MiFID II could affect the bigger companies, how the clients, the retail traders like us won't probably notice that side. What's the most likely tangible difference that we might see as retail traders from this MiFID II?
As a retail trader, you probably won't notice much difference in terms of the trades being executed. But what you will notice is that your interests will be served slightly better. Which is a good thing. You might not notice it from a trading platform point of view, but one of the things under best execution that is important to consider is that the regulators will be looking at relationships between brokerage and prime brokerage. Now, there are only about six or seven prime. This is very important. In the world, there are lots and lots of companies that say that they are a prime of prime brokerage. And what that is the prime, you have the bank, which is where the liquidity and the actual issuers of foreign exchange pairs are the tier one banks. That's the top level. That's the dealing desks that are making the market. Then one under that, you have on the non-exchange sector, which is what we're talking about, prime of prime brokerage, which basically is taking prime liquidity from tier one banks and aggregating it to get a single price and then selling that to retail brokerages. So many, many companies have the word prime or prime brokerage in their name, but they are not really prime brokerages. So that will be weeded out by the authorities, because they will not allow companies to mislabel their liquidity. Really, what they are, most of them are just retail brokerages selling a retail feed to other retail brokerages, which isn't prime. It's not prime liquidity. For those who are retail traders, you should always ask your broker, who is your liquidity provider? And if it is Saxo Bank, CMC Markets, Advanced Markets, Invast, Swissquote, IS Prime, or Sutton Financial, that is a genuine, those are the seven genuine prime of prime brokerages that exist. Apart from that, anything else that says prime on it that isn't one of those names is not a prime of prime. Which means your trades are being internalized by another brokerage instead of sent to the liquidity providers. So
that's really cool.
That's a problem.
I'm guessing that as retail clients, unless we had millions of dollars that we could bring to the table, we're not going to be able to go to Advanced Markets or any of those other ones you've just mentioned.
As a retail client, you cannot directly to take a prime of prime. But if you're going to a retail brokerage and you ask them who their liquidity provider is, they tell you one of those names, then you are going to a brokerage that's doing things right and they're giving you correct liquidity. Aside from those names, there really aren't any other prime of primes. CFH is another one. That's a prime of prime.
CFH, yeah.
But it, you know, that's eight. That's eight in the whole world.
Everybody advertises that they have Goldman Sachs liquidity and UBS and Barclays and all that stuff as well. Yes.
And quite often that is disingenuous and not true, unfortunately. Mm. You'd need a massive balance sheet to be able to get a prime brokerage relationship with one of those companies.
Yeah, you know, no doubt.
These prime of prime brokerages that I've just mentioned have to demonstrate, in most cases, a minimum of 100 million on their balance sheet just to maintain a prime of prime brokerage relationship with a bank.
Yowzers.
If you're a retail trader, that's very important. MiFID will be addressing this. So what is best execution? Best execution is sending trades to the liquidity provider or internalizing them according to the correct market price in the best interests of a customer. Now, that might sound simple, but there are so many facets of it, one of which is that brokerage relationships with its provider, which is something that hasn't been thought about very much. If an inspection gets done or a report gets made to a trade repository, which is where brokerages will have to send their trade reports, and the reporting authority doesn't really agree with where they want to know where this price came from or why this was executed like this, they can investigate it. So what they might check is things like, why did you B-booking is when you don't send it to the liquidity provider, you internalize it on your own dealing desk. But that's okay as long as the price is according to the liquidity provider's price. They might say, well, we did that to mitigate risk. However, let's say a trade does get sent straight through to the market, to the live market, which is a lot of focus on that at the moment. If you go to retail IB, retail introducing brokers, retail clients, they will say, are you sending our trades? Is it what they call an STP, straight through processing? Are you sending our trades straight to the liquidity provider? They'll say, yes, we are. But you know, they might be sending it to one that they've got favorable terms with, and the MiFID rules disapproves of that. If you've got two prime of prime relationships, and they're both giving you a good price, and you're sending the orders to one that's giving you the best terms, that could be construed as not giving best execution. So brokerages have to be really careful about things like this.
Is that sort of what FXCM got in trouble about while ago?
Yes. I mean, in a way, yes. So the NFA, in America, things are much more advanced. You know, the regulator is very advanced, and they know what they're doing, and they're recording everything and doing surveillance all the time. And they've had brokerages there have had to report trades on a daily basis for years, uploading their entire trade book every single day. But yes, what they got in trouble for was actually making public statements that the company was sending its orders straight through to the liquidity provider, i.e. there was no dealing desk at FXCM, and they were actually processing all trades straight through. So you're getting direct market access for a very cheap price. When actually what the NFA claims is that they were sending them to a market maker, which was internalizing and B-booking the trades, and trading against FXCM's customers. And then they found that they had that FXCM had an undisclosed interest in that particular market maker. So obviously it was a really, they can't prove it though, but it has become a very big issue, and it has done substantial damage to FXCM's business. You know, if they were banned from the United States, they pretty much don't exist anymore. This week, Global Brokerage, which is the entity that they founded after they were removed from the US, has gone bankrupt. So, you know, they've done a lot of damage. But this is, again, if that kind of thing is found out under MiFID II, if trading is not being transparent, then the brokerage will be subject to probably losing its license. And that can include you doing the right thing by your customer and sending as a broker and sending the trades to a liquidity provider. But if the inspection gets done that one liquidity provider has more favorable terms than another to the actual broker, that could be construed as a reason to actually not allow them to consider that to be best execution. So that's something I would really urge all traders and brokers to be very careful of, because it's an important matter at the moment, and it's something that isn't being discussed.
So to kind of summarize from your side, Andrew, it sounds like a very positive thing for the retail traders going forward, maybe a regulatory headache for brokerages, but frankly, all for the good reasons, because brokers have been known to be naughty from time to time.
Well, I think that's right. I think it's actually a very good thing. I'm all for it, because it's a good thing for our industry. From my point of view, as somebody who, whether it's considered this way or not, as somebody who represents the actual Forex industry, on a global level and is constantly working with the companies that make up the industry, it is a good thing because it will actually give us a much more sustainable future, and it will stop problematic companies actually doing damage to the reputation of the whole industry.
Excellent. Good to hear it. And you know, MiFID II was something that I could tell by my dumb question at the start, it was something I didn't really know a lot about. So it's been good to get my head around it.
Tom, I don't think that's dumb at all. I mean, there are many, many executives and compliance officers and even regulatory authority officials who aren't completely au fait with every aspect of it yet, because it just has not been explained to anybody, which is why a lot of specialist companies in this particular sector have held forums or in various areas that are populous with forex brokers like London, Cyprus, and Sydney. And they have actually invited compliance officers so they can explain what to do when it comes to reporting and making your infrastructure compliant to MiFID II. Now, of course, it does appear most people think, oh, well, what does it matter really? It's Europe, and there's no trading in mainland Europe anyway, which there isn't. But Britain is the center for the whole world's electronic trading industry. It has the highest level companies in the world operating there. And then you have Cyprus, which is a retail hub. There are obviously no customers in Cyprus, and most of the actual customers for the Cyprus brokers are not European. But there are 154 brokers there attracting customers from all over the world, and every single one of them will have to comply to MiFID II. And in my opinion, the vast majority of them, and I really mean the vast majority, will not be able to do so.
Really interesting, and it sounds like someone somewhere is doing a good thing, maybe not explaining it well enough.
That's
Europe. So we've got Europe, we've wrapped up Europe, we've 20 minutes worth of Europe. What about the rest of the world, Andrew? What's going on the rest of the world, and how can it affect the retail traders?
You have, over the last 4 or 5 years, the interest in the Asia Pacific region by retail brokerages has burgeoned. It has become a massive focal point for most companies. So a lot of retail traders exist in mainland China, and nowadays in Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and Thailand. So those are very different markets. The Chinese market is, China being a communist country, everything has to be based there. They're not allowed to transfer trades or money outside China. The brokerages they work with have to have Chinese infrastructure and be supervised by the government. All of the media has to be on their internet because obviously most internet sites are blocked that are not Chinese. So to be able to actually work properly there, you have to be based in China and be completely Chinese in the way of operating. But that has worked for quite a lot of brokerages, and they've onboarded a lot of customers there very successfully through networks of partners. However, Chinese government this week have started to take a dim view of brokerages that don't have operations there, soliciting lots of customers from there, and have actually cut off their payment supply. So there's going to be big changes there that will damage some of the business, because a lot of them have relied on not doing it properly and trying to solicit business in China without doing it right and put too many eggs in one basket, which means that once they lose that aspect of business, and I'm talking about small brokerages or some of the less than reputable larger ones that have been doing this the wrong way, haven't got any operations there, or have had a couple of brushes with law there, and the government have now blocked off their payment channels, and there are 40 brokers that this concerns. So that means that some of the retail customers in other parts of the world will probably find themselves dealing with a less than stable company in terms of balance sheet. So I would, my advice is to keep an eye on finance feeds, because we will be reporting in very great detail about this. We have a Chinese company ourselves, and we have a lot of reporting from within China, to be careful of working with companies that have had their supply in China cut off, because most of them are relying on it. And you really don't want to be trading with a company that has no money.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
You say that there are some larger, less than reputable. So it is some companies that people will know and potentially be listening to podcasts and trading with right now. So it's certainly worth keeping ear to the ground.
Some of those companies are large, but they are companies that are run in a disorganized fashion, and they don't have very good regulatory oversight. And they are sales orientated rather than quality orientated. And as a result, to use a phrase that you used earlier, some of them are bucket shops. And the government is aware of this and is going to put a stop to it. So as a result, it's worth keeping an eye out so that we can make sure that nobody gets themselves caught out, and so that they actually operate with good quality firms. And in my opinion, the good quality companies in this and the retail sector of this industry only exist in London, Sydney, most of North America and certain parts of the Far East, like Hong Kong. Apart from that, it's very, very, very difficult to find one that's actually a retail brokerage that's actually genuine. You know, if it was me and I was a retail trader, I'd be going straight to London or Sydney for a brokerage. ASIC regulation, good quality, long-established Australian brokerage, or an FCA-regulated, long-established, probably publicly listed British brokerage.
The one thing I have here in Canada is that most of those regulatory bodies don't want Canadian clients.
No, they don't. That's right. And actually, in Canada, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it's region, it's province specific. There's no national. The national regulation is very small, and the actual non-bank financial markets regulation is province specific. You're in Ontario, Brandon. So you probably, you know, the Ontario Securities Commission is responsible for Forex regulation in Ontario. But if you live in Manitoba, it's a different body.
Yeah. Some of them have a bypass system where they'll just follow whatever Ontario's rules are, but there's a IROC that's been created kind of combat that.
That's a bit of like a self-regulatory organization, but it's certainly, as you know, in Canada, it's really Ontario only that's doing it because that's really the only place where there's any FX. I mean, Oanda Corporation is based there. And you have some offices of some British firms there. But it is Canada is a place where there hasn't really been much regulatory turbulence. There hasn't been much fraud or problems, really.
Yeah. I mean, most Canadians go offshore anyways because they prefer to have the higher leverage.
That's right. And actually, if you think about the regulatory mentality, most regulators, apart from the NFA, which takes a proactive stance, most of them react. Instead of thinking ahead and working out how the technology works and how retail customers can get themselves into a pitfall, they are reactive. So what happens is they usually are in places of good standing, good business standing, like Britain, like Australia, like America, where there's not, you know, there's very little bad business ethic, but something has happened, like there has been a high profile collapse of a financial market, or there's been a big company that went down. Usually that's the reactive, and then it results in a reactive stance by the regulators, which tightens up the rules. So that's unfortunate. That's in Canada, it's never happened.
Yeah, in the States, it's happened. That's what happened with PFG Best.
That's right.
And that's kind of why the NFA decided to start actually regulating.
Exactly.
And yours truly had an account at PFG Best.
Really?
That was a great thing for me.
Well, that's why there were two of them. There was PFG Best and MF Global. And those two demises were largely responsible for the large capital requirements that brokers need now to put up, and for the whole structural changes. And it worked. It worked because most of the disingenuous companies that were not really suitable to be working in America pulled out. And now what you've got is a brilliant and very ripe area with a good client base, for good quality companies to go back there, one of which is IG Group, which we reported this week that IG Group has made a filing to reopen itself in Chicago, which is excellent news for American traders.
Interesting. Andrew, we've got out of time now, but I love the fact we've covered the whole of Europe. We've gone into Asia, we've dipped into North America, and we've covered all the kind of key pertinent things that are going on. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing your words of wisdom.
Great pleasure, and I shall look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Andrew. So the enigma that was MiFID II has now been semi-explained to me. I think I got 80% of that conversation. I'm glad you were there, Brandon, to kind of keep it going a little bit, because it is complex stuff. When you start talking about liquidity providers, then prime of prime brokerages and prime brokerages, and then FCA, MiFID, European whatever commission, you're like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, he is just a wealth of knowledge. I felt like that interview could have probably gone on for another 3-4 hours to really kind of pull out all that, you know, delicious information that's just floating around in his head on a daily basis. Like, imagine having that powerful of a brain between your ears.
Yeah, and then the contacts he's got. Every time I speak to him, is, you know, sat down with for dinner with the CEO of X, Y, and Z massive brokerage or whatever big firm within America. So he knows, you know, he's got the finger on the pulse. He knows what's going on, and he's got the inside track and lots of friends in the right places to get the truth from what's going on. So yeah, no, really lucky to have him as such a supporter with two blokes.
Yeah, it was a great interview. I mean, I wonder if you could probably hear my arse twitching a little bit because there were so many spots where I wanted to jump in and be like, oh, but what about this? We should talk about this point too, because it's really good, and all the listeners are going to be like, whoa, that's part of my life. I need to know that. There was just so many different ways we could have steered that interview. It just wasn't long enough. So I think we should definitely get him back on and borrow some more of that information from him again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what was the one specific area that you wanted to we can cover it now if we've got enough time, mate? Was there anything specifically you wanted to cover? Was it just literally generic? There's everything you could have gone into more detail and explained it better?
Yeah, it wasn't that it was about explaining it better. It was just like, there was just so many ways we could have gone. And I was sitting there going, oh, but what about this? And so I'm sure you'll edit that stuff out so people don't have to listen to me twitching. But it was good. It was good. It was really good to meet him.
Well, it's good to know that when you get excited, your ass twitches. So, I mean, again, it's all about spending time getting to know the other bloke and, you know, getting the idiosyncrasies that you may or may not be coming up with. So that's it's good to know. Thanks for that information, Brandon.
Hey, well, that's what I'm here to do. Share with
your all heart. So next week, we've got quite a special episode, haven't we? It's going to be a wrap-up episode of the year to date, and then looking at our best or most enjoyable interviews. Because again, you're not just a bloke that comes on the podcast and does the interview, but you've also, you know, you're an avid listener. And so we're going to go through the back catalogue, find a few of the gems from the past year and some of the lessons we've learned, and just really talk about them and how that's informed our trading throughout the year, and then moving on from that to a look ahead as well. So lots to look forward to next week.
Most definitely. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Last thing to say, that crypto competition is sadly finished. I'm still hoping, crossing my fingers, we're going to get some people on who had a trading system as opposed to a hold forever system. But if you are interested in getting involved in crypto trading, the XTB, you know, in my opinion, is a great place to start. Just like our crypto champion actually started on XTB, but maybe do a bit more due diligence, although it didn't really hurt him. But go to twoblokestrading.com/XTB and just sign up there and have a look around and see if it's the kind of place you want to get involved in training. Awesome, Brandon. Well, as always, it's a absolute pleasure to have you around, and I'm looking forward to the forthcoming year and wrap up and all that good stuff that's associated with it. I hope the jet lag stops and you're feeling bright and breezy for next episode.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, Tom. Glad to be a part of the movement of TBT.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Two Blokes Trading podcast with Tom and
Brandon.
Be sure to subscribe and check out twoblokestrading.com. And we'll see you back here next Monday.